I'll start as soon as I change the battery. Now, what we're going to do today is to talk some more about transport. We're going to start by talking of transport of small molecules, some aspects of channels we didn't finish, some models of active transport, and then how you put it all together to get something that is of importance physiologically done. And then for the remainder of the time today, we're going to talk about how you get big molecules into cells. So to start, there's some aspects of channels that we didn't really finish last time. This is not a good mic day. The first thing has to do with what people call gating, meaning the opening and closing of channels. That most channels are gated and that they can be closed or open in response to appropriate stimuli. And there are three kinds of stimuli that affect the opening of channels, and they are ligands, otherwise known as chemicals, voltage, and mechanical pressure. A chemical substance that binds to its partner, to a receptor, is called a ligand. So when there is some specific region on the channel that binds a chemical, we say it binds a ligand, and that causes the channel to either open or close, and those particular channels are said to be ligand gated. There are other channels which are open and closed in response not to chemical signals, but to voltage signals. Changes in voltage cause them to open or close. And there's a third kind of channel that responds to mechanical pressure by opening or closing. Now you might ask, what are these good for? Ligand-gated channels are very important in sending a chemical signal from one cell to another. Cell 1 releases the chemical. It binds to a receptor on cell 2 and opens channels or closes them in cell 2. Voltage, on the other hand, this one is used largely for cell-cell signals. Voltage-gated channels are very important in spreading the message down the membrane of a single cell. So this is very important in muscle and nerve, because you may remember that an individual nerve cell or neuron has this long extension or axon. So voltage-gated channels are needed to send the signal from one region of the membrane to the next, all the way down this very long membrane, this membrane of this very long extension. And then, as we'll see, chemical signals are used to jump the gap to the next cell, and then we do it again. Now, mechanically gated voltages are very important in things like hearing and touch and balance. And to put them sort of on the same scale, They turn external signals outside the body into internal signals. So they allow you to detect things on the outside. Now, so do some of the others, but that's really their function. Sound on the outside turns into some signal you can hear. Now, most channels are gated, but not all of them. You can understand why you'd have a gated channel. It would allow you to send some sort of signal. But what good is an ungated channel? And the most famous case of ungated channels are the potassium leak channels. These are found in all cells, but they're especially important in muscle and nerve in setting up the situation which allows transmission down an axon. Now, by leak channels, we mean these channels are open all the time, and they allow a little bit of potassium to leak through them at all times. Now, from what we've already said, what is the usual situation? Where is there more potassium, inside or outside? It is inside, that in general there's more sodium outside and more potassium inside, courtesy of the sodium-potassium pump. Now, if there's potassium inside in large amounts, and I have a channel, which I've called a leak channel, meaning that it's always open, what is potassium going to do? It's obviously going to go out, because it's higher concentration here, lower concentration here. Now, if you have a neutral substance and it goes through a channel, how does the concentration on the two sides of the membrane compare? Usually we talk about it not about going in, but going out. If we started with this case, we could say concentration outside versus time. If we measure the concentration outside with time, we would get a curve like this. Stuff goes out fairly rapidly till there's more outside, and eventually you reach a balance when the stuff is going inside at the same rate it's going outside, and you reach the concentration outside is constant. If we're talking about a neutral substance, we start out high inside, and we let it rip. What would the concentration be here? We start out high inside, and we just let it diffuse. Why don't you discuss that with the person next to you? If it were neutral stuff, and we started with high inside, high neutral, and we had leak channels for it, and we just let it go. When we finally reached a balance, how would the concentration inside and outside compare? Okay, let's take a look. You start with neutral stuff high, you open channels for it, and you just let it go. When you reach a balance where the concentration outside is constant, what will it be? Same as inside, higher than inside, or lower than inside? How many people think it will be higher inside? Higher outside? The same. Well, I agree with you. If things are going to diffuse out until the concentration here gets high enough that they start diffusing back in, and you reach a balance when they're diffusing in both directions at the same rate. Does it make any difference if we use an ion instead? Mm-hmm. Instead of starting with a neutral, we start with high potassium. Now, when do you reach a balance? You reach a balance when the push in equals the push out, right? For neutral substances, what is the push? It's just the concentration. For charged substances, what is the push? There are two pushes. There is the concentration push, and there's electrical push. And they could be in the same direction or opposite directions. Now, what's going to happen here? If we start out with overall everything neutral, we actually have both pluses and minuses in here. We have assorted ions. We have assorted ions out here. Now, what happens if potassium leaks out of the cell? What's going to happen to the charge situation here? Well, as potassium leaks out, there's going to be more minus in here than plus because some of the pluses left. So this cell is going to be slightly minus relative to the outside because the potassium left. When is it going to stop leaking? Which way is the chemical push? We started out with big potassium inside, low potassium outside. So the chemical push is this one. But now, after some potassium has left, what's the electrical push? Notice it's the other way. Potassium is positive. The cell is now negative a little bit inside. So the electrical push on a potassium ion is this one. And you're going to reach a steady state when the electrical push in equals the chemical push out. And that is not necessarily, in fact it isn't, when the concentration is the same on both sides. The constant will reach a constant, you will reach a balance with the potassium higher inside. But it doesn't keep diffusing out because of the electrical push back in. Now, the whole point of this is that because of potassium leak channels, the cell on the front edge is a little bit minus relative to the outside. This is where the so-called resting potential comes from, that all cells are a little negative on the inside relative to the outside. And this sets up an imbalance which can be manipulated to send signals.
Did we ignore the pump? We didn't ignore it, but we didn't mention it in the when we said before to reach chemical balance before we considered the electrical charge, we didn't consider the pump.
What is really, his question is about the pump. At any one time, the leak channels are working and the pump is working. So the pump is maintaining a high concentration inside and a little of that is leaking out. If you didn't have the pump, we artificially started from time zero. But if you didn't have the pump, you wouldn't have a starting high concentration here. So there wouldn't be anything driving the leak. So they're really working at the same time, but we've pretended first to think about the pump, and then forget about the pump and think about the effects of the leak on the levels already established by the pump. But in real life, both are going on at the same time. Are there any more questions? Yeah.
So the pump doesn't work harder in response to the leakage?
The pump does not work harder in response to the leakage. The pump is working, I would say no. All right. Now, I think that's all I wanted to say about channels. And I want to come back and talk a little bit about the mechanism of active transport. Last time, what we said was, for active transport, you blow some ATP and your stuff moves across. For secondary or indirect active transport, sodium goes down its gradient and you push the glucose around. So now I want to consider at the level of proteins and diagrams how this is thought to work. Now this is, of course, an idealization, but some idea of it is on 5E. We're starting with direct active transport, where we know that the hydrolysis of ATP drives things around. Now, there's more than one kind of pump, but the most famous one is the sodium potassium ATPase. And it is typical of a P-type pump. It's called a P-type pump because phosphorylation is a big deal here. That you can see in the middle that the protein has two forms, which are sometimes called E1 and E2. And what they differ by is whether they're phosphorylated or not. So in terms, you can also call them E as an enzyme and phosphorylated enzyme. So these are the two forms of your enzyme. Now they differ, and this is written on the two little things on the side. The two forms differ in several respects. They differ for their relative affinities for sodium and potassium. One of them preferentially picks up sodium, the other preferentially picks up potassium. We'll go through the actual cycle in a minute. In addition to that, one faces the inside of the cell and one faces the outside. So on one side, the enzyme or transporter loads up with one kind of ion. And then it's flipped to the other side, where it dumps the ion, picks up the other ion, and flips back. And the ATP is directly or indirectly responsible for the flipping. Remember we said last time that one way of regulating protein activity is by putting on phosphates and adding them off. Phosphorylation and dephosphorylation caused by kinases and phosphatases. This is a classic example of that, because the two forms are distinguished by having a phosphate. That you convert using a kinase and ATP. Remember, a kinase is an enzyme that adds the phosphate of ATP to something. And you get back using a phosphatase, which removes the phosphate. Now, these enzymes, really maybe ought to be called activities, these are actually parts of the pump itself. So the pump has a part that binds potassium, it has a part that binds sodium, it has a part that acts as a kinase, and a part that acts as a phosphatase. All of these are parts of the same large complex protein. So let's sort of see how this would work. This is the form that faces in, the E2 or the phosphorylated faces out. And this form has a high affinity for sodium and a low affinity for potassium. So on the inside of the cell, this form binds which ion? It's going to bind sodium. So the sodium climbs on, so to speak. And the presence of the sodium activates the kinase part. So the sodium binds, that activates the kinase, that phosphorylates the protein, and it flips conformation to facing the other way. But the E2 form, which faces out, has a low affinity for sodium and a high affinity for potassium. So the enzyme has arrived here loaded with sodium. What's going to happen? That's the sodium that it brought from the inside. But this form has a low affinity for sodium, so the sodium falls off. But this form of the enzyme has a high affinity for potassium, so the sodium climbs off, so to speak, and the potassium climbs on. And then that activates, the presence of the potassium activates the phosphatase. So now the phosphatase cuts off the phosphate. And once that happens, the protein reverts to its former form. But it's holding what? It's holding potassium, but now it's facing this way, low affinity, so it kicks off the potassium. Picks up sodium, does it again. So it picks up an ion, activates the right enzyme form, changes conformation, spits out that ion, picks up the other one, and does it again. There's a question? Now, the overall effect is written on the bottom of your handout. There's more than one way to write it. One way to write it is it takes sodium on the inside and potassium on the outside and flips them. So sodium out and potassium in, courtesy ATP. What is turning this is not the pressure of the sodium and the potassium. What is turning this is the energy from the hydrolysis of ATP. But what is triggering the turning is the presence of the appropriate ion. Now, we didn't put in the stoichiometry here. That's on the bottom of your model. But per ATP, you actually move 3 sodium and 2 potassium. Now, that means that this pump alone, if it were uncompensated, would cause unequal charge on the two sides of the membrane, and the cell would be minus relative to the outside. But most of this charge difference is compensated for by the movement of negative ions. So that although it looks like it should, this unequal exchange of positive ions is not responsible for most of the charge distance difference across the membrane. Most of the charge difference across the membrane is caused not by the pump's unequal exchange, but by the leaking of potassium. Now, this is primary active transport, and there are other kinds of primary, but in this one, the phosphorylation of the enzyme by ATP is driving the operation. Now, I want to leave this, but before I do it, let me ask if there are questions about this model before we look at secondary active transport, which is on the bottom. Yeah?
What's guaranteed that the protein we know, where is the in and out of the cell?
How does the protein know which is the in and the out of the cell? Probably it is the way when the protein is made, it is inserted into the membrane in a particular orientation. Therefore, it distinguishes in from out. Yeah?
Change in the concentration of potassium in the out of the cell.
Now, can this work in reverse? All pumps can work in reverse. If the concentrations of sodium and potassium are appropriate, let's just say high enough, you can run this backwards, in fact, and make ATP. Now, in a real cell, given the concentrations and the orientations of the protein, this can only be run in one direction. In a test tube, it can be reversed. Now I want to talk about an example of secondary active transport, or indirect, and that's on the bottom. Now here we're talking about sodium glucose co-transport. And this is a case of Symport. Both of them go the same way. The glucose goes down, the sodium goes down its gradient, and the glucose follows. Now, again, you have an enzyme with two forms, which are conventionally called A and B, but they could just as well be called E1 and E2. Now, what is different about this case is that in the case of the sodium-potassium pump, the protein has two forms. Let's say this one and this one. But this form always faces one side, say out. And this form always faces one side, say in. There are two forms, and each one always faces its appropriate side. In the case of the sodium glucose co-transport, the protein has two forms, but either form can face either side. So you could think about it maybe like this. These are the two forms of the protein, say, open, closed, grab stuff, don't. But it can face either way. It can do it either way. And that means that this whole setup has somewhat different properties. And in fact, it is much more readily reversible. Now let's see how it would work. We're not saying who faces in and who faces out, because it could be either way. But we're saying the A form has a low affinity for glucose, and the B form has a high affinity for glucose. And what switches one form to the other is the binding of sodium. So we could start wherever we wanted, but let's see, where should we start for this one? Let's start here with this form of the protein. Well, maybe it's easier if we do this one. What switches these two is the binding of sodium. So if we are have high sodium, sodium will bind to the protein. And if it does, the protein will be in the B form. Now, once it's in the B form, it has a high affinity for glucose, and it binds glucose. So this protein is going to have both. Once it has both sodium and glucose, then it flips shape, it flips sides, and it dumps the sodium. So adding sodium takes it from A to B, dumping sodium takes it from B to A. But it is probably the glucose that causes it to move. Let's say this another way. What we're talking about here is not rotating to face the front and the back. What causes it to rotate and face one side or the other is if it has both sodium and glucose, it goes to the other side. Or if it has nothing, it probably goes to the other side. To move, it has to have both or neither. What's going to make this run in a cell is where are you going to find high sodium? On the inside or on the outside? High sodium? Inside or outside of the cell? This is outside. So this is going to be outside. So this form of the enzyme normally faces the outside. On the outside, you have sodium, so you're in the B form. If you're in the B form, you pick up glucose. If you have both, you turn to the other side. But once you get to the other side, namely inside, there's no sodium to speak of. So the sodium falls off. It just diffuses away. But once the sodium falls off, the affinity for glucose is low, and the glucose falls off. And if it's empty, it can flip back to the other side. Another way of thinking it is, if it's facing the outside, it sees sodium, and it picks up glucose. If it's facing the inside, it sees no sodium to speak of. Whatever sodium it has floats off, and any glucose it has floats off. So in a living cell, it always sees high sodium on the outside and low sodium on the inside. And that determines how it behaves. One analogy to this one is a revolving door. In the case of a plain old glucose transporter, also, you have a revolving door. Now, what's the difference? A plain old glucose transporter, what determines, let's say the door always turns the same way, but what determines whether the people go in or the people go out? It's the concentration of people. Think about that door over there. Another way of thinking about it is with a big business, a big commercial building. In the morning, lots of people come in through the door at 5 o'clock in some buildings. They all leave out the other side. They all leave the opposite way through the same door. It's the pressure of people on the door that determines which way it goes. With a plain old glucose transporter, it's the same thing. If the glucose is piled on this side, it goes this way. The glucose is piled on this side, it goes that way. Now, in this situation, you have a revolving door, but it will only turn if it's either empty or has both things in it. If two guys have to fit in the door or nothing. So the sodium allows the glucose to come in, full door, around it goes. Once the sodium falls off, the glucose falls off. Now that it's empty, it can turn around again. the ATP synthase, the ATP pump, the sodium potassium pump, also called sodium potassium ATPase, is a little more like a, it's not exactly a revolving door. It's more like one of these seat-activated things, that when the sodium sits down, the weight of the sodium behind sort of activates the switch, and that activates the kinase, and that makes it turn around. And then the sodium guys get off, and the potassium guys sit down, and their weight triggers the switch, and that makes the phosphatase work, and the protein goes around it. Yes.
So once the protein has dropped off the sodium and glucose, what makes it turn around to the outside again?
It's not clear entirely to me what does, but the question is what makes it turn? I think the answer is if it has nothing in it, it is capable of turning. But if it has only one, it has either have nothing or it has both, it's capable of turning. You could conceive of this protein as switching back and forth or turning spontaneously. But if it turns with, I don't think it can turn without both. But if it's empty, you can think of it as spontaneously going back and forth. But if it's empty and it faces this way, nothing happens. And if it's empty and it faces this way, it picks up sodium and glucose, and that presumably triggers it to turn. Where does ATP come in? Very good question. Is there any ATP?
In the pump.
He says in the pump. Directly, there's no ATP at all here. But what would happen if you ran out of ATP? What are you using? You're not using ATP directly here at all. That's why this is called secondary or indirect active transport. But this only works if you have a gradient of sodium high on one side and low on the other. And where did you get the gradient of sodium? Active transport. So this is indirectly dependent on ATP to provide the gradient, but in the short run, it's running off the gradient, not off ATP. Yes?
Were you saying that the switching between the open and closed forms of A and B is only dependent on whether or not sodium is down?
Yes. Presumably, sodium here is what switches you from here to there. Once you have both sodium and glucose, you go to here. Once you lose the sodium, you go to here. Now the empty one apparently flips back to the other side. In other words, you could say this one could represent either side. That happens to be accidental. But this could be on either side. But it's only opened on the side where there's sodium, then it picks up glucose, then it goes to the other side. Then it loses both and is empty. Now I wanted to mention one other kind of transporter before we leave this. This is an active transporter called an ABC transporter. And that stands for ATP binding cassette. These proteins were first discovered in prokaryotes and were largely ignored in eukaryotes. But we now know that these class of proteins is very, very important. And that this is a different kind of pump in which the hydrolysis of ATP pushes things across a membrane. But the way that this kind of pump is or transporter is different from what we've been talking about is that these classes of transporters move all sorts of things across membranes. The traditional pumps that we've been talking about move ions. But here, by the hydrolysis of ATP, you don't usually move ions. You move other things. And different pumps move different classes of things. ABC transporters tend to be less specific in that a particular one will transport not just a single ion, courtesy ATP, but a whole class of molecules. And the first protein like this to be discovered in humans is called the MDR protein for multiple drug resistance. This protein protein is a pump that pushes hydrophobic compounds out of the cell. So it causes resistance to a large number of drugs. The drug goes into the cell, and then this compound, this transporter, pushes it back out again. And the way this protein was discovered is that people who had cancer and were treated with chemotherapy, they would have surviving cells that were resistant to the chemotherapeutic agents. And the surviving cells turned out to have high levels of this protein. So the cells that had low levels of this protein were killed by the chemotherapy. But the cells that had high levels of this protein, when the drugs came along, they just pumped them out again. And so the chemotherapy acted as a selective agent. It killed off the sensitive cells and left the resistant ones. Now, there's several other interesting examples in humans of this kind of protein. And there's one in your notes with some links about the protein responsible for the type of earwax you have. Turns out to be an ABC transporter. And this may sound very silly, but there's an indication that this mutation has spread very widely. And what is the selective advantage of having a particular kind of earwax? So people think it must be linked to some other function, like how much you sweat or something else, which has some real advantage. And there's an article, a popular and a scientific article about this, linked to your web notes. And the only other example I want to mention is what is called CFTR. This is the protein whose defect is responsible for cystic fibrosis. This is called the cystic fibrosis translocation. I can't even remember right now what it stands for. But the point is that this protein has the same similar structure to the ABC transporters. It's a transduction regulator. But the point of this protein is that it is not a transporter in the traditional sense. It has a similar structure, but it does something a little bit different. It is a chloride channel. And it uses ATP, but the ATP is not used to push the chloride. The chloride goes down its gradient, but counterbalanced by the electric push. But ATP is probably used to gate this channel. So ATP is needed to open it or to close it. Now what happens is that people who have cystic fibrosis, the protein is not inserted properly in the membrane. The protein is made, but it's defective and it never gets to the membrane. And so the membrane has no channel for chloride. And as a result, there's a total imbalance in salt and in many other related matters. And there's actually a large section in Becker that explains the symptoms of this condition. Now, what this hints at is that not every transport protein is going to turn out to fit into a particular category, that there are going to be proteins that look a little like this and a little like that, as this one does. It has, in many ways, the structure common to an ABC transporter, but it turns out to be a chip. And people are just now discovering more and more of these transport proteins and more about their particular structures and functions. We've been talking a great deal about all the various kinds of transport. Passive transport, active transport, primary, secondary, blah, blah. So what I want to do now is put it together and look at an example of where all of this is actually used to do something. And that's on handout 5A. And what we're looking at here is how glucose gets from your stomach, from the food you eat, to the body cells so that they can run metabolism. And what you're looking at here first is These are the cells of the epithelium that line your digestive tract. So these are meant to represent the cells that we use the orange juice cartons for again. And there are many of these. And of course, in real life, they form a layer. And the layer surrounds the digestive system. So we're looking at this layer. Here would be the lumen of the intestinal tract. And whatever you ate would be in there. And you remember from last time, this is the apical surface. This is the basolateral. So the body is over here, the rest of the body. It's here, of course, it's really all the way around. But we're just looking at it in terms of one side. Now, your body cells are down here somewhere. How does material get there? You have, of course, the circulatory system, which we've drawn here, which is filled with the blood. What material has to do is it has to pass across this layer of epithelial cells, through the spaces between the body cells into the blood. Then it's carried by the blood throughout the body, and nutrients leave the blood at various spots, again go through the spaces, and enter the body cells. And what we want to see is how glucose does this using all of those processes we've talked about so far. Well, first of all, you notice that the epithelial cells are joined by tight junctions. Therefore, liquid cannot pass between the cells. If glucose is going to get from one side of the layer to the other side, it's going to have to pass through the cells themselves. And so the first thing that's going to happen is the glucose is going to have to go across the apical surface of the cells. And it does this by glucose sodium cotransport. Well, for that to work, what does the sodium situation have to be? It has to be higher in the lumen and lower in the cells. What keeps the glucose low in your cells? The sodium-potassium pump. And that's actually on the basolateral level, below the basolateral side of the same cells. Now, every cell has a sodium-potassium pump. And in this case, it's on the basolateral side of these same cells. So the pump is working in the background, keeping the sodium low, so that that differential can be used to pump glucose into the cell, from less concentration created to more. So this is primary over here. This is the sodium potassium. Now what happens, so primary active transport keeps the glucose low, secondary active transport brings it in. What now happens to that glucose? Well, a little of it is used by the cell itself to run itself for its own energy. But most of the glucose is not used by this cell. It is passed on to the rest of the body. So the glucose has to leave through the basolateral membrane. Now this time, we don't need ATP or sodium because glucose is high in these cells. It's been pumped in. But the glucose is relatively low in the rest of the system. So glucose can leave using carrier-mediated transport or facilitated diffusion. Glucose can get across this, glucose can go down its gradient. Or the glucose concentration can power transport. But can glucose just diffuse across this membrane? It cannot. It's hydrophilic, it needs some kind of carrier. And so there's a carrier protein here, and you have here carrier-mediated facilitated diffusion using a protein that is called GLUT2. Now, GLUT stands for glucose transport. And this is a family of proteins. And we'll come back in a minute and talk a little bit more about it. is they carry glucose from the high concentration side to the low concentration side. But it turns out there are a whole bunch of them, and some of them are used to bring glucose into the cell, and some of them are used to bring glucose out of the cell. How can they work both ways? So, and sometimes the same one may be used in two different cells in opposite directions. Because remember, this is like the revolving door. If you have a lot of glucose on this side, it pushes the door and the glucose goes this way. If, on the other hand, there's more glucose on this side, then we push the revolving door and glucose goes in. In this case, the glucose is higher inside and it flows out. Yes?
How come that carrier-mediated flow sheet isn't used to get glucose inside the cell?
Okay, why did we use a different one here? Because the glucose concentration is high inside the cell, and it's relatively low in the lumen. So since the concentration here is low and higher inside, it's against the gradient, we need to push. Now, once the glucose is in the spaces between the spaces between the cells are filled with what is called the IF, not intermediate filaments, but the interstitial fluid, as written on the left here. This is the fluid between the body cells. And glucose can diffuse through that. How does glucose get into the small blood vessels, the capillaries? The capillaries have a single layer of cells actually surrounding them. To be more accurate, if this is a capillary, the cells are like this. The cells aren't like that. The cells surround it. But you have a layer one cell thick, just like you have this layer here, one cell thick. And these are, again, epithelial cells, but the ones lining the blood cell, the blood vessels, are called endothelial. These are the cells that line the blood vessels. Now, in the capillaries, which are the smallest blood vessels, as shown in your picture, there are spaces between these cells. These cells are not joined by tight junctions. That means that there are spaces here, or that the very small blood vessels are leaky. The larger blood vessels have other layers around them, but the capillaries don't. They have only this thin layer of endothelial cells. Now, since there are spaces between the cells, that means that material can diffuse through the liquid between the cells. So glucose can enter by simple diffusion. Now, notice it's not crossing a membrane here. It's going in the space between two cell membranes. In all the other cases, it crosses a membrane, but here, it's just going between the cells. Now, you've all heard of the blood-brain barrier. That's because the capillaries in the brain are surrounded by cells that are tightly joined. The capillaries in the brain, you can't pull this. Things cannot diffuse easily between the cells because the cells are tightly joined. But in all the rest of the body, these endothelial cells are not joined. Now, the gradient of glucose goes down and down and down. The gradient of glucose here is lower than here, is lower than here, is lower than here, is lower than here. And we'll see why that is in a minute. But that means that glucose now is going down its gradient into the blood. One way of thinking it is, of course, the blood is washing it away, so the concentration of glucose is low. So the glucose is carried through the blood, and then at various spots along the way, it can, in fact, diffuse out of the blood, the blood vessel into the interstitial fluid, which here has a low glucose concentration. So this is more interstitial fluid, low glucose. Now, why is the glucose here low? Because the glucose is sucked into the cells. Now, how is glucose going to get into a cell? This time it has to cross a membrane. Now, the concentration inside the cell is very low. It's actually lower than in the interstitial fluid. So if the concentration inside this cell is lower than outside, what kind of transport do we need? Is glucose going down its or up its gradient? It's going down its gradient. So what kind of transport? We're going to need another example of carrier-mediated facilitated diffusion. And in fact, we're going to use a different member of the glute family usually, a different but very similar carrier-mediated carrier protein. So there's going to be a different glute here. In most body cells, you have glute 1. Glute 3 is in neurons. And glute 4, which is the insulin-regulated one, is found in muscle and in fat cells. Now, before we get any further, I just said something. I said the glucose inside the cell is very low. How can a cell run metabolism if it doesn't have any glucose? How come the glucose inside the cell is very low when we're pouring glucose in? The trick is the phosphorylation of glucose. If you look inside your body cell, which I'll now blow up at the bottom, you see that it says muscle or adipose. Adipose is fat, but for any body cell, the first thing that happens to glucose when it gets inside a cell is it is phosphorylated using the appropriate enzyme and ATP. And that traps the glucose inside the cell. First of all, glucose 6 phosphate cannot pass a membrane. There's no carrier protein for glucose 6 phosphate. So it can't by itself get out of the cell. Second of all, since the glucose is converted instantly to glucose 6 phosphate, the free glucose level is very low. So this phosphorylation trick, in a way, pulls all the diffusion. Because by phosphorylating the glucose, we keep the free glucose in this cell very low. That allows glucose to go down its gradient, interstitial fluid to cell. That keeps it low in the interstitial fluid and pulls it out of the blood. That keeps it low in the blood, which pulls it out of the interstitial fluid near the epithelium, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I want to say a word about this glute family. We talked about intermediate filaments being a family of proteins. Here also, these are a family of proteins, meaning that all of these proteins are similar in structure and function. If you look up the picture, and there's a link to one on the web, all of these proteins have 12 transmembrane segments. So if this is the membrane, all of these proteins go like this. Except I'm going to dot it out. There are 12 of these. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, I left out 2. 12. And the carboxyl end and the amino end are both inside. So all of these proteins have the same basic orientation and the same basic setup. But they differ slightly, and they have somewhat different properties, and are there, which seem to fit with their roles in the different cells. We won't go into the fine points, except the issue of glute 4. Before I say that, for all of these, glucose can be transported in either direction, depending on the concentration. For most of these, the protein is always used the same way. In this particular cell, in the epithelial cell, glute 2 is always used to bring glucose out. In the average body cell, glute 1 is used to bring glucose in because the glucose is higher on the outside than the inside. Now, glute 4 is actually the protein we mentioned last time. Do you remember we said that some proteins can be inserted into the membrane or removed from the membrane? All the other glutes are constitutive. Once they're made, they stay in the membrane. But glute 4 is in a vesicle, which can either fuse with or defuse from the membrane of the cell. So glute 4 is inserted into the membrane in response to insulin and removed in the absence of insulin. Now, if this is a body cell at the bottom, it would have glute 1 or glute 3 and it could take up glucose all the time. Brain can always take up glucose, liver can always take up glucose. But muscle and adipose, as it says on your bottom of your handout, they use GLUT4. So that means that you have to have insulin present for these cells to have a door to allow glucose in. In the absence of insulin, these cells cannot take up glucose because they don't have a door in the membrane. Diabetes type 1 is caused by an absence of insulin. Therefore, although you make the transporter, you can't put it into the membrane. Type 2 diabetes or adult diabetes is usually not the absence of insulin, but the absence of response to insulin, and is more complex. Now, I want to remind you that in a multicellular organism, such as a human, all the cells have the gene for GLUT1, the gene for GLUT2, the gene for GLUT3, the gene for GLUT4, blah, blah. All the genes are the same in all of the cells. But different genes are turned on in different cells. This is what people call gene expression. GLUT1 is expressed in most body cells, makes RNA, makes protein, etc. GLUT3 is expressed in nerve. GLUT4 is expressed in muscle and adipose, etc. So the difference here is not in the gene, but in its transcription and translation. And how that's regulated is something to which we will return. Now, we have looked at this process from the point of view of the steps in order, where glucose goes. Across the apical surface, across the basal surface, into the blood, out of the blood, into the target cell. You can also look at it from the point of view of where do we use diffusion, where do we use facilitated diffusion, where do we use primary active transport, where do we use secondary. And there's a sort of summary of that in your notes, but I don't want to go over it now. That's for you to try yourself. I want to now ask how large things get in and out of cells. So let me ask if there are any questions before I go on to that. Yes?
So glucose sodium per transport is only used in getting glucose into the epithelial cells and nowhere else?
Is glucose sodium co-transport used anywhere else? It's actually used in some other epithelial in the body. It's used in the epithelia surrounding the kidney tubule. But in most cells of the body, you don't use glucose sodium co-transport, only in a few select few. Any other questions? Yeah?
The concentration of glucose in the blood is lower than the interstitial fluid?
Well, the concentration in the blood in this area, near the epithelium, is lower than in the interstitial fluid. But in most of the body, the concentration in the blood is higher than in the interstitial fluid. Yes?
Why is the concentration of glucose in the
The reason the glucose level is higher here is because glucose is being pumped in from the lumen or concentrated from the lumen courtesy of sodium co-transport. So these cells are serving two functions. They're getting glucose for themselves to eat, so to speak, but they're also passing most of it on. Yeah?
When your body uses other macromolecules for energy, where does that convert?
What were you thinking of?
Protein.
Well, protein is generally broken down to amino acids and small peptides, and then it's transported in a similar way across here and into the blood and into the cells and then broken down further in the cells, in the target cells. So this is not the only nutrient. We're just concentrating on this one for now. Yeah?
Are there actually certain cells that we use the same protein backwards?
Are there any cells that use the same protein backwards? It's thought that some cells do use GLUT2 in both directions, but most of them use their particular carrier in one direction. But some people think that GLUT2 serves as the sensor in pancreatic cells, that when glucose is very high, it goes in instead of out, and that serves as the signal that I better secrete insulin and I better do something. These carriers don't all have the same ability, they don't have the same ability to bind and transport glucose. Remember that these carriers can be considered like enzymes that have a KM or an affinity for their substrate. And these have different KMs or affinities for glucose, so that some of them transport glucose well at very low concentration, and some of them transport only well at high concentration. GLUT2 apparently only works well at high concentration, but that doesn't matter, because GLUT2 is here, where there's always a high concentration in the epithelial cell. So let's think about big stuff. How does big stuff get into a cell? There are actually three ways it can do it. We're going to concentrate on one, but just for the record, we'll say what the three are. And they are rhinocytosis, and receptor-mediated endocytosis, or RMP. Now, all cells are thought to do pinocytosis. This is a kind of endocytosis, which is nonspecific. So the cell membrane, this is the outside, invaginates a little bit, and then a vesicle pinches off. Now, this is pinocytosis, or cell drinking, and what is picked up is just a sample of whatever was floating outside, an indiscriminate picking up of whatever liquids and dissolved materials happen to be floating around. And all cells are thought to do that. Phagocytosis, on the other hand, is restricted to specialized cells that have the appropriate cytoskeleton to extend pseudopods. So with phagocytosis, the cell extends, if there's, say, something out here, the cell extends its areas using the cytoskeleton and eventually joins them there would be more cell back here. So maybe we should just draw dot, dot, dot. These two pincers come all the way around and join. And now the material is engulfed within a vesicle when this pinches off. And only certain specialized cells can do this. The phagocytes, for example, can do it. This way we engulf invading bacteria and viruses are engulfed in this way by a specialized cell. Now, I want to concentrate on receptor-mediated endocytosis, in part because it's the best understood. And the trick there is that, again, you have a pinching in. But instead of being indiscriminate, there is a receptor on the surface of the cell. So what is specifically brought into the cell is whatever binds to that receptor. If the cell invaginates now, the receptor and its ligand will find themselves inside a vesicle. And this is sort of like, like fishhook or something. You're able to grab multiple molecules of ligand out of solution and bring them into the cell. And so, you're actually concentrating the ligand here. You're not taking just a sample of whatever is floating around. You're fishing in, you're pulling in, either with Velcro or fish hooks, whatever you want to call it. You're bringing in specifically a particular molecule that binds to a receptor. Now, cells have many kinds of receptors, so they bring in a collection of ligands that match that receptor. And this is then called receptor-mediated endocytosis. And we think that virtually all cells do this, but different ones have different receptors and catch different things. what's important about this? Whenever you have a membrane that bends, in any of these cases, you have to have a protein that helps the membrane curve. And so that when you, this protein has to be present on the inside of the membrane. So that when you form a vesicle, it is going to be surrounded by this protein, which is usually called a coat protein. All forming of vesicles involves coat proteins. Now we have two important proteins here. In order to do this, we needed the receptor protein, and then we needed this coat protein, or this 2B coat protein. Now notice that the receptor protein, what kind of protein is it? Is it a peripheral or integral membrane protein? Noted that this is an integral transmembrane protein. But what about the coat protein? As we'll discover, coat proteins are all peripheral proteins. They are floating around in the cell. They stick on, help the membrane curve, form a coat, and then they're reused. They come off again and are reused. So they are peripheral proteins. They are not integral proteins. Now there are several different peripheral coat proteins. Depending on which membrane in the cell is doing the budding, you use a different coat protein. The one used by the plasma membrane and used in RME is called Claflin. There are others, but this is the one we're going to concentrate on. And Claflin is actually used for vesicles forming from the plasma membrane. And it's also used for vesicles from the going from the trans Golgi. This is the far side of the Golgi, which you might call the end. Things come in one side and out the other. This is the outside. Now, you notice, although maybe it's clearer, if you look now in handout 5C. Where we've drawn the beginning of exocytosis. RME is actually a cycle where material is removed from the plasma membrane, goes through the cell, and at least partially back to the plasma membrane. In other words, endocytosis is balanced by exocytosis, so that the area of plasma membrane remains the same. And also, what is inside the vesicle is what was outside the cell. And that's maybe clearer if we look at it. Here is a little bit of plasma membrane with some receptors. We've drawn here two different kinds of receptors. A real cell would have many, but for simplicity, we've only written two. And there would be an area of the membrane that had Claflin attached to it, right here. So that would be Claflin, or potential coat protein. Now, when the receptors bind their ligands, that is the trigger for receptor-mediated endocytosis. And what happens? Here we've drawn only one ligand matching one receptor. In a real cell, there'll be many receptors with their respective ligands. You have to keep that in mind. Now what happens is that the receptors move laterally in the membrane to the area where the Claflin is. Remember, fluid mosaic, things can move in the membrane. Some receptors move only if they have met ligand, some move anyway. And the area where the Claflin is starts to invaginate or bend in. So you get a structure that looks like this, and you would have some empty receptors and some full ones with their ligand. And this is called a coated pit. Because in the electron microscope, you can see that there's stuck on this side of the pit. And this is the peripheral coat protein. Now, what happens is that the membrane continues to bend in until it forms almost an entire vesicle, and then the vesicle pinches off. So where would that put our stuff? Our coat protein is going to be on the outside, and our receptors now, whether they have ligand or whether they're empty, the receptor part of the receptor, the part that binds ligand, the part that used to be on the outside of the cell, is now on the inside of the vesicle. Topologically speaking, the inside of this vesicle is equivalent to the outside of the cell. And this material can actually pass all the way through the cell without the stuff that was on the outside ever touching the cytoplasm. The stuff that used to be on the outside is all sequestered. Now, this process requires energy. We are specifically ignoring exactly the fine points of where. But this, at this point, is called a coated or endocytic vesicle. And remember, we said that the coat protein can be recycled. So the next stage is to take off the coat protein. This is the step 5. And now what happens is the coat protein is released, and you have an uncoated vesicle, and it's still got the receptors and the ligand inside. And the coat protein can go back to the membrane and form another coated pit and do it again. And now is the part which varies for various cells and various cargos, that is, different ligands. What happens next varies. One possibility is that this vesicle will simply go to the other side of the cell. If you think about these kind of cells we've been talking about, these cells have two different domains with two different sets of proteins. And a vesicle can butt off one side, go through the cytoplasm, and butt off and fuse with the other side. And the net result is that a protein picked up on this side will simply be spit out on the other side. And the stuff that's in the middle never met the cytoplasm. It was just ferried from one side of the cell to the other. And that is called transcytosis. Another possibility, and that's what a diagram's here, is that this vesicle will simply go around and fuse back with the plasma membrane and spit the stuff right back again. In which case you have exocytosis balancing your endocytosis, and you essentially return everything back to where it came from, back to the plasma membrane. On the other hand, what can happen is this material can be sent to a lysosome and completely degraded. In other words, whatever it is can be spit out of the cell, or it can remain completely in the cell. Now, it isn't all or nothing. It turns out that the material in here next goes to what is called a sorting vesicle, and it may be that both receptor and ligand will go the same way. But in some cases, the receptor goes one way and the ligand goes the other. And what we will do next time is bring back this handout, because we will consider some specific examples of how you sort out what you took in and decide who goes where and how you send it there. Okay.